Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey everyone, I'm Attila J. Abbott, the writer, director, producer of the film A New York Christmas Wedding. I'm here on Hellblazer with Chris Gordon.
Everyone, I have the honour and the privilege of the company of Attila J. Abbott today, who is the creator and also one of the actors in A New York Christmas Wedding, which is now showing on Netflix, well, mostly across the world, as we've just found out, but also on the online streaming as well. So, yeah, welcome, Attila J. Hal, thank you for joining
us. Hey, thanks for having me.
No, thank you. I really appreciate you coming on. It's great to always, for me, it's always great to talk to people in the industry. It just spurs me on. I just love it. Listen to the inspirations that people have. And especially for this film as well, because I have watched the film. I did watch it the other day.
Thank you.
Sat down with my wife and it was a really good, obviously going to that anyway, but it's a really good film.
I always say that's the best way for the film to be viewed is with a spouse, a partner, or friends, because when you watch it, there's different perspectives of how you took in the project. So it's good that you didn't watch it alone and just say, I hate Christmas. You saw it everyone, someone else, and kind of talk about what's good, what's bad.
Yeah, exactly. You can sit there, you know, it was good. And you can see the aspects of it and think, oh, you know, in certain areas, it's like, okay, yeah, you can see how it goes and how it molds. And I say the actual premise behind it, again, we'll go through this, it's just very, very good. And I know the modern take of obviously Christmas Carol, which we'll go into.
Yeah.
But it's really so nicely done that it's far enough away from it without knowing, you know, and far enough away from the original story, but then with the elements that draw you back, which was really nice.
thank you.
No, you're welcome. So, kind of, I told you, how old were you when you decided this was the thing that you wanted to dedicate your life to?
Well, it's very interesting because being someone from New York City and growing up in a way of immigrant parents, my parents are from Nigeria. I was born here in America, so my upbringing was almost more about scholastics and kind of sports. But then when I graduated from St. John's University in 2008, the economy was going down in America. And I had great advice from my friend that said, you know, it's going to be hard to find jobs. So what do you want to do right now with your life that if it's not a financial thing, it's something that gets you up and going every single day. And that was always pursuing the arts and being an actor. So in 2008, I started pursuing acting. So 2008, I believe I was... I can't do the math right now, but I guess I was 23. Yeah, I started pursuing the arts, and from there, I saw incremental progress. And here I am 10 years later, and here we have a feature film and a short film, and we still keep on going.
Excellent. It's really inspiring to hear how you got into that as well. So I was okay. That is great. And obviously, you did grow up in Brooklyn as well yourself.
Yeah.
So how was that? How does that? Because I mean, Brooklyn. You hear? I've never been to Brooklyn. Been to New York, but I've never actually been over to Brooklyn. So.
Well, growing up in Brooklyn was very exciting. It was at the time in the early '80s, late '80s, early '90s, where it was all about community. You step outside and you have neighbors who aren't just your neighbors down the hall, but neighbors on different apartment buildings and different homes that are right there. So for me and my sister, we would go outside and play block parties. My mother and my mother and father were always working. So my sister and I were always finding ways to entertain ourselves. And I think that's where the arts for me, you know, I always put together little plays or little type of shows in my living room with my sister, and she'll be bothered. And I'll say, let's do it again. But Brooklyn was definitely a place of imagination because I didn't grow up in a suburb. I grew up in a city. So literally New York City was our playground.
Wow. It's pretty impressive, to be fair. Isn't it? It is a great city. And I guess the experience of growing up in a city is completely different. Obviously to me, I did grow up in a city. That's wrong. Then I moved to North Wales, which is the coast, and it's like in the sticks
over here. Well, it must be pretty though. A good place to be like creative and, you know, write, hopefully.
Oh, it is definitely. I mean, I, I, I'm very lucky. I actually live 400 meters from the beach, and it's like, I think it's about 7 miles of golden sandy beach and sea.
Oh, nice.
At the moment, it's not nice because it's really windy and cold, but in the summer, it's lovely. You sit on the sand dunes and I can write poetry or I can start looking.
Oh, beautiful.
Just looking across the mountains and stuff. It's really good.
You have to bring me out there to write my next film.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's some great castles, and so you can really have a great kind of a scenery and storyline around here.
Yeah.
so did you also do any theatre work as well, more theatre work in there?
Yeah, so when theatre was something that, again, growing up in New York City, we don't have those community theatres. It's, if you're a young kid and, you know, if there's some type of financial kind of worries, you have the playground, you play sports, basketball, baseball you could play as well, but you only have a seasonal time. It's not a year-long thing as if you're in Florida, California. So the real outlet for any type of child was sports and a playground. And I always wanted to pursue arts and theater, but I never had the type of opportunity to say, let me try it and kind of grow, went into that. Until I went to the prep school, the Gunnery in Washington, Connecticut, and I went there as a postgraduate after high school. And from there, I had my first time auditioning for a play. There was an audition for a play called The Picnic by William Inge. And I auditioned for it. My first time doing something, I got the lead role. And from there, it was almost a fulfilling thing where I got to perform and do something I wanted to do. And now I'm doing it in a safe place where the arts are very, very much encouraged. And it's funny that we went through rehearsals for the play. We had, it's a prep school, so you only have 3 performances on a weekend. It's not as if you have a 3-month run.
Yeah.
So after our final performance, our third one, you know, we had a curtain call, and you know, we're getting applause, and everyone's excited for what they just saw. And I remember thinking to myself, I'll never forget this moment. I said, "That's it. After those 3 months of hard work and those only 3 performances, that's it. I want more." And right then and there, I had the acting bug, and from there, started pursuing a lot more arts, and I got the opportunity to assist direct a Broadway play that championship season. So my theater credits started building more and more and more because I was someone that wanted to be involved in the community and learn.
Excellent. I mean, in New York City, so, you know, theater is one of the best places to do theater in that respect.
Yes.
It's funny that you didn't have the community theater and you went around it that way as well, which is great. Yes. But I know what you mean, because when I was in high school, I did acting in high school, and it's something I always regretted that. Probably why I do my podcast now, because I always regretted I never followed it.
But I did
the musicals as well, and it was right, because you rehearsed for so long, and then we literally had like 3 performances, and at the end of it, you deflate. Is that it? You have a taste for it. It's like, I want more. That was brilliant.
And it's so interesting, because after we did that play, The Picnic, and then the next semester, they were doing another play, but this time it was a musical. It was You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And I never got to experience what it takes to make a musical. And I didn't act in it. I just wanted to be a part of it because I was so much invested in the community that we did a play together. And now it is another play. I'm not going to be a part of it, but I'm not going to be a part of it on stage, but I'll be a part of it behind the scenes. So I got to kind of experience. And I think I forgot about that. That was probably my first experience of working behind the scenes, still enjoying the aspect of being a part of a team. And it was just something that I'd never, never forget.
Excellent. And it's such a different, I mean, the difference between, obviously there are similarities between screen, TV, film, and obviously theatre, but there are so much differences. I think with a theatre, there is, like you say, there's much more of a family vibe because you grow so close to them because you're in each other's faces pretty much for months on a rehearsing. So it's definitely a different experience. So obviously you've gone through with screen as well, obviously going through the theatre and stuff. You've gone through screen role. You've had some pretty good roles as well. You're welcome again. It's like, you know, some great shows there. Some of my favorites as well, like The Blacklist is one of my awesome shows. Brilliant. What was it like filming on that?
Oh, The Blacklist. That was, I believe that may have been my first network primetime, if you want to say, show. And it was the first season. It was the final 2 episodes. And it was at the time of The Blacklist where they don't release a whole script. They just give you a part of it.
Right. Yeah.
And I really, when I got the script, part of the script, and I said, I didn't know when on film the day of, if I was a bad guy or a good guy, because it's just about action, do this, do that.
Yeah.
And you know, now you have these action type of projects where the bad guy is a good guy or vice versa. Like, you know, so it's like Red is a bad guy, but he's a good guy. So I didn't know what was kind of what I was supposed to follow through. But in the end, they were just saying, go in here. This is your motivation. You do this, you do that. And it came out pretty well. I mean, with doing an NBC show like that, the production value is so high where if you come in and you just, again, play, the people around you will support that and make it look pretty good.
Fantastic. As I mean, first, you know, your first sort of network show to be on is a hell of a show to be on as well. So, you know,
and it's still going too. So that's even exciting. It's a lot. I had a lot of friends and family that would pop up and see it now years later, because I believe it's a syndication, and they'll say, oh my gosh, I knew you were on this. And it's funny because I'll tell everyone I was on it when it happened, but people are like, oh, you're doing a little acting thing. But then when they start popping up and seeing you by chance, then they start believing that you're really doing it.
Fantastic. I mean, James Spader really is good as Red.
He's fantastic. He's fantastic. And just the idea of his character work too, because, you know, James Spader was a heartthrob, and, you know, he's someone who, playing what he's playing right now as the character Red, you're seeing an actor that is really embracing himself into his own body as part of his life, rather than trying to be this heartthrob that he was back as a teenager or early 20s. So it's really, I mean, he's a fantastic actor. He does great work.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, that wasn't just your only one either. You've had quite a lot. I mean, the Defenders as well is another big top show, which has gone out. Yeah. So that's pretty good. But one I was interested in on your IMDb is Romeo and I've not seen it. And I wish I wanted to go and look for it. It's Romeo and Juliet in Harlem. Cause that sounds to me pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's funny because I was in an acting class with the cast director, Lita Chappelle, who just direct as well. And we did Romeo and Juliet in Harlem. She adapted the script to make it become more of Harlem based. And at the time, it's not ahead of its time, but it's innovative in a sense of you're seeing these Romeo and Juliet characters. And now instead of switching genders, you're just making a racial thing in Harlem. So Harlem, going back to about being in a community like Brooklyn, Harlem itself is its own community too. So what happens when you have these characters in Harlem and they're speaking Shakespeare, they're taking the train, you know, they're walking through Central Park and they're going up to Brownstones. It was just a very, very exciting type of project. And I actually got to work with Harry Lennox, who was in Blacklist on Romeo and Juliet in Harlem, which is great. And I got to play the character of Paris where, you know, it's funny because with Romeo and Juliet, I wasn't Romeo, but I always felt like she should pick me because I was like that perfect guy. But she was like, you're too boring and bland. So that was that.
Excellent. No, it does. I'm going to try and find that because it does sound really good and a great concept to move it across there like that as well. I did have Harold Perrineau once, who was Mercutio in the
Hero. He's fantastic in that project. I mean, I think Boz, he really showed how you can adapt something and make it not even modern, but just make the story so similar to people today. And everyone has tried to do their own iteration of that. And I think Romeo and Juliet in Harlem is something different, but everyone wants to get where Boz did it. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio, Claire Danes, these are phenomenal young actors at the time that kind of brought this timeless type of tragedy, you would say, a love story to modern day people, an MTV generation, if you want to call it. So it's exciting to kind of be a part of that kind of canon.
Definitely, definitely. And you are, so get on to that again, but with the film that you've got now, you are bringing that sort of classic literature, even. I can't even speak properly. Classic literature. And you're turning it into a modern way around as well. And obviously, your director, I've lost my teeth. Sorry. Your directorial debut, obviously, in 2018 with Jitters, and that was a short feature. So how did you find it then, going from a short feature to a full feature film itself?
I found Jitters for me was one of the most exciting things I've ever done at the time, because I've written a feature film script before that, and the hard part is people won't fund your film unless they prove what you can do.
Right.
So I was very inspired by your Lena Dunhams, inspired by your other writer directors who write something, they star in it and said, here is a platform for me and please take me HBO. But with Jitters, that wasn't the case. So I knew I had to show people what I can do. So I wrote and directed a short film that basically could highlight my artistic type of point of view to everyone else. And I got going back to the idea, like, my parents are from Nigeria. I'm from born in America. So I come from an African household in my home. But then when I step outside in the world in school, I'm around Americans and also a different culture because of New York City. So my point of view to the world, or even my point of view to the world is very, very different than anyone else, because I have all these different cultures clashing, and what I put out there, it has to be something that would be hopefully unique. Yeah. I think Jitters was a prime example, because I got to show the side of a man before getting married and show his nerves or jitters, more or less. They showed that without having to be apologetic about being emotional, be apologetic about being ruminative. So I think people really found the universal quality to that. And then after that, the feature film happened, and the feature film is something where it's, that's definitely the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah. Hardest thing.
Yes. Yes. Yep. It's very, you know, it's a journey. We shot Jitters in 3 days, and then we then shot the feature film in 14 days, because it's, people say when you make a short film, it's hard, but you might as well make a feature film, because when you have the momentum, you got to keep on going.
Yeah.
And we kept that momentum with A Near Christmas Wedding, and it was difficult, but we definitely got to see the benefit of it, because we made a feature film, and not many people could say that, because they do it, so people don't finish it. But for us to do it, get friends and family involved, and then get it to Netflix is something where it's a job well done.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. Like you say, I mean, I've spoken to plenty of independent filmmakers and stuff, and the projects that they have, which they, like you say, they don't finish, or they don't get round there. But I feel, I think a lot in more recent years, platforms like Netflix, Amazon Prime, Vimeo, all those platforms are really, really pushing and helping filmmakers get your products out there and get your films shown. I think it's really, really great. One thing actually depressed me. I saw someone make just off topic. Okay. Something said they were remaking Short Circuit. They were doing a remake.
Oh,
and I went on a rant on the post, and loads of people actually liked my comment. I was like, why? I said, why do you keep remaking classics like that? I said, we've got so many talented writers, so many talented filmmakers out there who are creating and doing creating masterpiece films and shorts, feature films and everything. Why can't they just put their money into those? Yep. And push those out. I said, there's so many 100%. People out there. And I've got loads of likes for that, which I was like, there's a lot of people out there.
People think what you think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, people know.
But it's funny because, you know, you would hope that they would have a budget to match that. But with Short Circuit or any other thing where they do it again, it's they know there's an audience there already, which is totally fine. But let's go back to the time of independent cinema, independent artists are not rewarded in a sense, but just supported, basically. It's that you make something, you did it, know how difficult it might be, it got somewhere, so your Amazon and other streaming platforms. So for the next one, you tried without one failing, and you tried and got it done. So the bigger, the higher studio should be able to kind of pick talent, I think, and then from there, give them an opportunity. But, you know, it's, again, now you're in a business where people almost like politics, I don't want to get into that, but people want to stay there. People want to stay there and have an easy job keeping up for 20 years, but it's like, no, you have it for 5 years, pass it over.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's something we started, I was pushing for here as well with some of the filmmakers, trying to get them to in the cinemas, but people who make shorts, I said what they should do in cinemas and stuff now is show people short films and, you know, independent short films is where the trailers are. You could have a short film showing, and then you can actually introduce people to the, you know, all this new talent as well. That way, I thought there's loads of ways people can to move, or even have like a New York Christmas Wedding stuff, you know, have that one showing one night a week or something.
That'd be amazing. I can't wait to go back to a theater and kind of have people see their experience, like see what they have to say about it. And, you know, everything might not be great in their words, but in the end, I want to have a conversation about the film. I want people to kind of talk about it and just see what they think, because we all see things differently, like I said, whatever is someone's experience isn't a wrong one, but if they can voice it and have the conversation, I'm totally open to all of that. And that happens in theaters, because when you leave a theater, you hang around the lobby, you hear people talking about what they just saw. And we missed those. Now we have to go on internet blogs and Twitter, and you just see people trying to be comedians so they can get their things retweeted rather than speaking honestly about what they feel.
Yeah, exactly. And talking about the fact that people have got different views on it, how did you actually come up with the idea for the film?
Yeah, so Jitters was the film that I thought was a good example of what I can do as a writer-director. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, a producer. We started our production company, Woeful Productions, because of Jitters. And from there, I had a friend named Corey Apton who's a part of Conglomerate Media, and they she saw the film, she enjoyed it. She said, this would be a great opportunity if you could make something like this, but for Christmas, but at a feature level. And she gave me four things to do. She wants to have New York City, mm-hmm. a wedding in a church, a same-sex couple, and so New York City, a wedding, a same-sex couple, and Christmas, and in the church, those four things. So I basically wanted to kind of adapt Jitters into that type of story, because now I have opportunity, because of my short film, mm-hmm. to now make a feature film, and people like Jitters, so this is perfect. I can make a feature film about Jitters, and I'm building my way up into this career. But when I try to expand Jitters, it didn't work, because what's good about short stories, as you might know, is that the tighter they are and the shorter they are, they're better that way, because you get right to the point of the story rather than trying to add this character, this place, that place to kind of fill time. Mm-hmm. So it didn't really work. But then I took what was really important about when people saw Jitters, they were surprised to see two men getting married in the church and it be normalized. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be very, very emotional for me in a personal way, because people can't see that because it's not real. But in the film, they enjoyed seeing that for 12 minutes. Yeah. So then I thought, if it's not real and they want me to do a wedding in the church, how can I make this happen in a realistic way? And then I started exploring these different ideas about the question I'm asking is that, like the character Gabby does, it's like, I was baptized in this church, I was communed here, I was confirmed here, why can't I get married here? Mm-hmm. And that's a question I would ask myself about different people who stepped away from the church because of the fact that they are not marrying the same sex. So because of that, I started exploring that and put out a treatment. Corey Apton and I sat down for about 2 months and got the story together. And then we had a script, and months later we were filming.
Fantastic. It's lovely to hear that as well. I love the fact that you just given four ideas and that you
wrote it. Yeah. It's okay. It's funny because now all my friends are like, why do you start writing? I'm like, I'm writing stuff. They're like, oh, well, I'll give you more ideas. I'm like, I don't want any more ideas. I just want to go from what's organic or what people want to hear about or see now.
Yeah. Isn't that as good that you chose the Catholic Church as well? Because obviously the Pope, was it this year or last year?
You just come right out with it.
That's, so you obviously, you know, that's been incorporated in the film as well. I can see that.
Which I think is very exciting, because hopefully people on, and even your critics or either the Catholic people who are Catholics or Christians could see that they could see the modern day telling of that in a film about what the Pope is saying, like how it affects people rather than a soundbite from the Pope. And, you know, my fingers are crossed people will kind of pick it up in that way.
Oh, I'm sure they will. So, because that was a part of this, obviously, the Father Kelly side of him struggling, because obviously he knew Gary and he wanted that, and he knew what love is love, and that's how he built. And obviously you can see that battle, probably ruining the spoilers, by the way. You can see that battle, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
That internal battle there, and of the belief of his faith, and obviously then of just love. And it was nice. It was a really great sort of that, like you just said, that integration of affairs into the storyline to help along the way was really good. And so I think people will see. My dad was a minister in the United Reformed Church.
Okay.
And obviously he progressed through with things as times changed as well. He was very progressive in his thinking, which was great to see. So he's quite respected like that. But I know there are other denominations where it's not, and it does take that time, and so it does need someone like the Pope, etc., to come out and do what he's done, because he's been a right breath of fresh air.
Yeah, definitely. It's like a lot of people, or some people, when they tune in this film, they, because it's on Netflix, they have the idea it's going to be a very cheesy is the wrong word, but a very lighthearted type of romantic comedy for Netflix and Christmas. And that was my intention. But again, when Corey wanted me to write this, Jitters came from a very personal place. So I couldn't do this in a way that wasn't organic for myself or what I feel. Mm-hmm. And at that point of time, I really felt very strongly about the idea how in New York City, things are a lot serious in New York City. Everyone's not happy walking down in front of the Plaza Hotel. We have those moments and we have them in the film, but a lot of people are more, it's strong. It's New York City, it's a hard place, and that hard place is other people's stories. And mm-hmm. I think other people's stories involved with the idea of you know, with Christmas, it's a religious thing as well. We kind of stepped away from the idea of gifts and deals on Black Friday, but in the end, the core of it, it's the idea that there's birth and there's death, and I try to explore that all in our film.
Definitely, and it does work out. And obviously, like the tagline is, obviously, you can see the Christmas Carol inspiration in there.
And we
have that with Azrael. I'm not going to go into the whole ruining it for everyone who's not seen it. But obviously, with Azrael being that connection of, you know, like the ghost who visits. And I love, it was a lovely little twist. But for me, it was a little twist at the end. Obviously, and things like that, we just brought it all back. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, you can sort of, when you know that you've got that kind of an inspiration of that literature behind you, and you can see going in there. And it was just, I just thought it was really well done and brought in, like you're supposed to be brought into the 21st century, like they say, which it is. And having the same sex couple, I think is really, it's really great and progressive, because obviously it's, you know, it's bringing that out into the forefront and like what we just talked about there with the mixing it with the religion, it should be hopefully bringing people to see on screen now that, you know, this is acceptable. It's something that's normal. It's everyday life. It's love.
Correct.
It's love no matter what.
And
that's the story that we should be pushing out, rather than, you know, trying to segregate people left, right, and center.
Correct.
It's, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, whether, you know, what religion, background, sexual orientation, your color, or anything like that. We're the human race. That's my view on it. And it's just let it go.
Yeah.
Just let everyone live how they want to live. And that's this film says that, but it does. It pushes that really across.
Thank you. Yeah. I wanted to kind of really just explore the universal aspect of love. So what happens too, for some people who sit down to watch this film, they aren't aware of the same sex type of relationship, but they are still following the story because it's still a love story. And that's the what I want people to kind of experience and go through, is that in the end, some people like labels, some people don't, but we're labeling this film as a love story, and that's what it is.
Exactly. And to be honest, you don't focus on whether they're a same-sex couple or not, because you're just following that love story throughout. It doesn't matter who their protagonist. Well, obviously it does, because that's part of that story.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to diss part, but that's what you do. But you follow the love story, and it could be anybody there. But for these two guys, it's girls. It's just, that's just my, the way I speak.
No, it's okay.
It's you just follow those two and that story, and you just root for them the whole way. And it's such a lovely, lovely turn. So when it came to casting for that, did you have the guys or the people already in mind?
Because we were doing this on a budget and it's my first feature film, I knew I wanted to work with people that I worked with as an actor. So Nia Fairweather, who plays our lead Jennifer, I did a reading with her at a theater company called Labyrinth in 2010. Mm-hmm. We never worked together. She moved to California pursuing her craft. And when this came about, I wrote it with her in mind because she was one of my favorite actors that I've worked with, only in a reading. So basically we only read a play for 2 days. And then from there, she went on her way. And I remember talking to her after we did the reading, and I said, you know, you should be on TV and big screens, you know, and I mean, I'm the kind of person that says anything. And she's like, yeah, I know. So ever since then, and this is the reason why I really want to pursue producing a lot more, is that I want to be able to give my friends opportunities because I see their talent, and we can't wait for studios or industry to kind of give them that cosign. So what I can do, whatever I can to help out. So Nia came on board. She loved the script. It was her first feature film in a leading role. Then after that, I had Adriana DeMeo, who plays Gabriella Vernacci. She came on board, and we have a mutual friend who basically knew I was writing the script. He's like, you're describing my friend Adriana. And I basically went to her, talked about the story. She liked it. She read the script and she came on board. Then after that, we had Chris Noth, who I worked with on Broadway. He's been someone who's been a really good mentor to me over the years. And he actually executive produced Jitters, my first short film. And we had Jason Patrick in Jitters, the actor, and then we had this feature. Chris wanted to be a part of it in some way. So I showed him the role of Father Kelly, and he was very not excited, but he liked the conflict of the priest. It wasn't just another sappy thing. He liked the idea of, like, this is something he never got to play. He would love to do that. And then my mother, played by Tyra Farrell, who's in White Man Can't Jump, Boys in the Hood, we were in a film festival together. I never met her. I reached out to her and said, hey, I'm a first-time feature filmmaker. I've been a fan of your work for a long time. Would you mind reading the script? She read it, and we talked on the phone, and it was interesting. She told me that I've never been offered a role or got to act in a role that was such of a high-class person. She's someone that, you know, she worked with John Singleton. She worked with all the great Hollywood directors, but she's always playing that middle-class woman who has the struggles of the world. And a lot of, you know, she's played that. She plays it well. But she never got to really play and explore being someone who has affluence. And yeah. She was like, I would love to do this. And then from there, I had to start casting the kids to match how these older girls look. So I had friends who were deaf, who were casting directors, and I reached out to them. And we didn't have a budget. So basically, I reached out to people. Mm-hmm. Our producer, Corey Apta, we held casting auditions. And we cast the kids. We cast Cooper as Azriel, who was phenomenal in his audition. And it just started snowballing. You know, you get Chris Noth involved, you get Tyre Ferrell involved, and you start kind of like, we're doing a film and this is our date. People come on board. And what also helps too is the fact that I had a short film to kind of to show what I could do as an example. And I always go back to Jitters because that's, for me, that's my Trojan horse. You want to see something, here's Jitters. But then they saw Jitters and they knew that the similar themes and tones could be spun in a feature film for Christmas. Mm-hmm. It's a good type of mix.
Yeah, definitely. That's amazing story to have to get that cast in. They were all superb as well. Nia, the lead role, she was fantastic. She really was. I mean, they were all great. I'm not going to knock any of them. But and to get some of those names, like you say, the ones that you've respected, and they just jumped on board.
And I also had to cast myself in a way because I was cheaper to hire in the sense of, you know, because when you're doing a low budget film, you reach out to people. And I reach out to people, play the role, but they didn't get back to me because, mm-hmm. you know, everyone has their own idea of Hollywood calling them. But I knew I wanted to be on set and just have people that want to be there.
Yeah.
And now it's funny because people that didn't get back to me before when I asked them to be a part of the film, now they're reaching out because it's on Netflix. So it's funny how that happens. But I just knew for a fact that if I was a part of the role, and I kind of wrestled with it. A lot of people said, you don't have to be in it, just be behind the camera. But then mm-hmm. I had other people that said, you are this character, you better be in the film because you're a likable person on screen and in life. So mm-hmm. people have to not root for David, but they have to like him.
Yeah.
So if they like the character, it makes your story stronger. So that was that. And then I also have my dog in the film, Willa. She plays Smudge.
All right.
The dog in the alternate world. So it's definitely a lot of friends and family have been a part of it.
Fantastic. How did you find acting in your own film while you're actually, you know, in the same?
I felt this time around it was not as stressful as it was for Jitters.
Yeah.
Because Jitters had about, I remember the first day we did 9 pages of all dialogue. And it's me and my co-star Walker Hare, who's phenomenal in the film. And because the film is titled Jitters, I could be nervous about directing, producing, acting. So it all worked in that sense. But for this one, I was very supported by the actors across, just being truthful in the moments and just knowing that someone like Nia Fairweather, my main motivation and goal is to show my love for her, to protect her the best way I could do it. And I think that kind of, because we had the rapport of, like, as a director, actress, and rehearsing and talking on the phone, there was an ease to us. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed acting in this film, but I also felt like I'll be behind the camera. And then it's like my scene has come up and then all of a sudden I have to sign paperwork for SAG, you know, all these different things are happening, but it was good to kind of just on screen, just kind of be relaxed and just play. And, you know, we had a lot of coverage, and since we had the same crew as Jitters, we knew how to work together. So it was great.
Fantastic. It's nice to see that you were involved in that as well. So it's because I was sitting there watching, because I thought, I know, waiting for it. And then suddenly I saw you on screen, and you do feel so, you do empathize with the character as well, which is obviously exactly how it's supposed to be. So it's, and you, especially towards the end, and you're thinking, well, what about him?
that was one of my favorite parts of the film, is that when she has this choice, she sits there, and I won't give it away, obviously, but then her main thing, she's worried about him rather than worry about herself.
Mm.
And I think that shows a lot about her character, and I think it shows a lot about the reality of what the kind of bond they had together. When she says, when she mentions, you know, Gabriella, he's mm-hmm. very happy for her, because that was her past, but then he wants to move forward. And to then have, you know, Azriel remind her he'll be okay, I think is something that people could kind of watch that scene and realize, yeah, he will be okay, but now what about you? So I think that's a really good moment of the film.
Definitely, definitely. And it was great. And as you say, Cooper as Azriel played that.
Oh, Cooper, yeah. Yeah, I have friends, one of my friends from Ireland, he was saying, he's like, the Cooper character, you hate him, you love him, you laugh with him, and then it's just like all these different layers of like sinisterness. And we talked about it with Cooper, is that you meet, at first he's very happy, he's excited, mm-hmm. he's someone who is on the streets and he's talking, you don't know who this person is, but you kind of like his warm heart. And then when he wakes up, then she wakes up, he's someone who is more now, I have a job to do, this is what I'm giving you, and you mm-hmm. do it. And then when he comes at the later point, he's like, it's more business now.
Yeah.
And at the end of the film, it's more business, but it's also heartbreaking because they have this bond together that, depending on her choice, what would happen.
Exactly, yeah. And it was, yeah, that did get me as well. I was just sitting there thinking about that.
But
the whole film, I say it's on Netflix now, but it superbly comes together as a lovely Christmas film. So we'll be watching it again. it was one of those which you can watch over and over because the story is so lovely to tell.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. I'm going to ask you a signature question now.
Okay.
You've been prepped on this one. I normally spring this right on people.
Okay.
So the reason I've got this backstory is someone who came on my show once who was an actor. He's been with Jim Henson, who'd been a puppeteer for 30-odd years.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
And someone sent the question in, and I thought, you know what? That's a really great personality question.
Yeah.
So if you could have a Muppet created on your own, based on your own personality, mm-hmm. what Muppet would it be? It can either be a new one, or it could be the existing, or a mix.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting because obviously I would want to be a new Muppet because I want to be my own person. Mm-hmm. But I think the similarities to Big Bird, I think that'll be great to have. Big Bird's a Muppet, right?
Yeah, he is. I
hear the word Muppet, I think about the angry men, angry critics or whatever. But
oh, yeah.
But Big Bird's a Muppet. But I just like the idea of a Big Bird being someone in Sesame Street who is larger than life, mm-hmm. very sincere, very emotional, but also very much a kid at heart. And I always I remember watching, and this is very interesting actually, I remember watching, I forgot the film with Big Bird where he gets lost. I remember my mom bought the tape of it, and Big Bird gets lost and he's at a circus and they capture him and he's singing songs. And that was the first time where I saw in the narrative where Big Bird's a very happy person, and then they forget him at like a gas station, and then some bad guys capture him because they found this big bird, and they take him to the circus. He's a talking bird. He could sing. They tell him to sing. He doesn't want to sing. He misses home. But it was so much for me to experience this very jovial character missing out on home and having to be alone. And I always felt like, wow, I was very emotional, touched by that at the age of like 6 or 7. And yeah, I have a really strong connection to Big Bird.
Okay, great. Nice answer. And before I stop recording, is there anything that you'd like to say to people who are watching or listening?
Oh, yeah. I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to listen. Hopefully you could go out and catch and stream A New York Christmas Wedding on Netflix. It's a film that's made about love. It's a film that we wanted to go to studios to make it, but studios, like I said, they're not going to give you money for your first film because you have a first film. They want to see what you can do. So we didn't say no. We just went out there and made our film, and I'm very, very excited with the feedback we're getting because our film right now for 2020 is one of 5 films that highlight or showcase a type of queer type of love story. And all those other 4 films are $1 million films, and we are not that, but we are still being risen to the level because of our love story that's universal. So hopefully they can share it, see it, and keep on supporting. It really means a lot.